From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the group that doesn't want to just be known for their hit of La Bamba. Los Lobos is a Chicano group that draws from Mexican musical traditions to create their own style of rock and roll. Also, we talk with Walter Mosley, the hero of his first novel is a black private eye whose first case takes him into a hostile white world. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead looks at how a couple of saxophonists are blending their own cultural traditions with jazz. And music critic Milo Miles remembers guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan. Vaughan was killed in a helicopter crash today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today offered his best wishes for the diplomatic efforts to end the Middle East crisis, but said he saw no reason to compromise on demands for an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. The president said he welcomed a new diplomatic initiative by UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. The secretary is set to meet with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz on Thursday. President Bush said he'd strongly oppose any move by the Secretary General to compromise on U.S. and U.N. demands that Iraq withdraw from Kuwait, that the former government be restored, and that all foreign nationals be allowed to leave if they wish. Members of the West European Union met in Paris today to coordinate their planned naval enforcement of the economic sanctions against Iraq. Six of the nine nations belonging to the organization are deploying ships to the region. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
New details of the joint operation were learned today when the Belgian defense minister said three of his nation's ships, already en route to the region, will patrol the Gulf of Oman at the entrance to the Persian Gulf. The defense minister told Belgian television that the ship's mission will also include sweeping for mines. There have been reports that Iraq has laid mines, but much further inside the Gulf. Other ships from the WEU member nations will patrol two other weak spots in the embargo, the Gulf of Aqaba, which leads to the Jordanian port of the same name, and the Gulf of Aden, where loaded Iraqi oil tankers are believed to be at anchor. Military officials from the WEU continue to work out details of the joint deployment and coordination of the European efforts with those of the United States. This is Brian Naylor in London.
A bipartisan group of senators is on a tour of the Middle East. Today they got a close-up look at the U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. NPR's John Idstey reports.
U.S. senators, including Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole of Kansas and Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn of Georgia, came to this air base in Saudi Arabia today to check on the deployment of U.S. troops in Operation Desert Shield. The senators shook hands with the troops, asked how things were going, and took messages for the folks back home.
Just tell them I love them and doing the best we can over here, sir.
After their tour, Senator Nunn said he saw no military option for getting hostages out of Kuwait and Iraq. He also said that after this stop, the senators were headed for Egypt to talk to President Mubarak about sending more Egyptian troops. I'm John Idstey, reporting from Saudi Arabia.
Prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street after a day-long rally based on an easing of fears about a potential war in the Persian Gulf. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 79 points to close at 2,611.63. Advances outpaced declines by a margin of 6-1 in moderate trading. Volume was 160 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of people know my guests as the group that re-recorded the song La Bamba for the 1987 movie biography of Ritchie Valens. Los Lobos is a Chicano band from East L.A. whose sound draws from rock and roll, Tex-Mex, and traditional Mexican music. My guests are Los Lobos' chief songwriters, David Hidalgo and Luis Perez. Hidalgo also sings, plays guitar, accordion, and percussion. Perez plays drums and guitar. Los Lobos' 1988 album, La Pistola y el Corazón, featured their interpretations of traditional Mexican songs. Their new album returns to rock with a Mexican tinge. From the new album, The Neighborhood, this is Be Still.
Like the smallest rose out of the hardest ground, like a
Perez, David Hidalgo, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wondering what effect the Mexican album you did a couple of years ago has had on your playing and composing.
Oh, gee, I think it's had a great deal of influence. We started off playing that sort of music exclusively for almost 10 years, and it was after the rock records, after the big hit La Bamba.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, everybody
Let's
remembers.
Let's get that out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was, getting back to that stuff was really refreshing, and I think it was real important for us to get back into the old, playing those folk instruments and playing that sort of music. So when we came time to, sitting down and writing material for the next record, it did have a lot of influence on our recording approach, on our writing, instrumentally. We had an excuse for getting all the broken stuff out of the closets and fixing them, so we were able to use a lot of those things on our...
The broken instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
Be Still, which we just heard, is, I think, the most Mexican-influenced track on the record. Is it hard to bring elements of Mexican music and rock and roll together in one piece?
Yeah, yeah. It's something David and I always wanted to do, but stayed away from it only because we'd never really had the right handle on it, or because so many attempts have been made that we've felt that we're not really that successful. That they always seem to come off a little, as novelty songs or something, where an English lyric is sung with a Mexican rhythm. Or different elements, brought together. So David experimented with the huapango, which is a traditional Mexican rhythm, and mixed that with a rock type approach to it, and then the lyric having a more, if you will, a serious sort of theme to it. It just all fit perfect for us. So. It was an experiment that worked out that might just be the beginning of a direction that we might want to explore.
David, was this new for you to combine Mexican and rock and roll music together in one song?
Yeah, like Lou was saying, it's something we've thought about for quite a while, but we were never able to do it successfully. This is the first time that it actually worked.
Was there ever time you felt you had to keep the Mexican music out of your music, out of your commercial music, the band's music?
No, I think what happened was after spending so many years just playing Mexican music, when we finally found ourselves back in the garage with, all of our amps and guitars and drums and everything else in between, we started to mix it up. We started... took the same approach some jukebox would have in South Texas. It doesn't just play the music, doesn't think about categories or anything. So we started mixing it up, and then once we got some headway with the audiences locally in the clubs and the local music critics at when we finally came to signing the band, they frankly didn't know what to do with us. There was this strange band that played Mexican music and rock and roll. But Warner Brothers, our label, decided to do the intelligent thing. Just leave us alone. Try not to find a any particular niche for us. Let us carve our own. And in doing so, just left our music intact, which was a blend of traditional music and traditional American roots rock and roll, and then our writing kind of, fell somewhere in between the two.
Just as your music is a mix of different styles, do you feel that your lives are a mix of different cultures too?
Oh, yeah. Living in Los Angeles, there's a lot of, you're exposed to a lot of different cultures, and, it's available there if you look for it. And so we've been influenced a lot of different things.
Do you still live in East L.A.?
Basically, yeah, in L.A. County.
Yeah,
a little further east than we
used
to be.
East of East L.A.
Yeah.
What's the neighborhood like?
It's a place called Whittier. This little town was founded about 100 years ago, And there's still a lot of these old homes standing. It has a real small town kind of feel to it.
Yes, and it sort of reminded me of the, you know, living in East LA in the before it became Ground Zero, you know.
Yeah.
It had that same old feel that I remember growing up, and with the corner stores and the, you know, church about two blocks away, and the little ladies watering the grass at 7 in the morning, and kids playing up and down the street. So that was something I wanted to kind of bring my family to, you know, have them experience that sort of thing, especially I've got small children growing up. And it's something I share with David here, because we've talked a lot about things like this. So we live about a mile away from each other, and we kind of have that same idea about a little town, that the real community type spirit that we're looking for in a neighborhood, and that's what this particular town has. And I'm working on trying to move my mom out of the old neighborhood, get her over by where we are, because the old neighborhood is going through another transition back to the decay is really starting to set in more permanently.
Were either of you in gangs when you were growing up?
We kind of stood on the outside, yeah. Somehow. We kind of knew, you know, we were musicians, right? And for some reason, musicians were always had this, you know, protective coating. And we went about and moved around a lot of different people and different types, and were pretty much protected, because the strange thing being a musician was always like, you know, like you play a backyard party, the cops would always bust it, and you'd always be left alone because you were the guys who were playing the music, and usually you're the blame for the fact that the neighbors complained in the first place. I could never understand that, but we moved around and talked to a lot of different, you know, gang types that were our friends, you know, low riders, collegiate types, you know, all different types that lived in the community, and we were able to move freely about and get to know the different elements of choice, and we decided to stick it out and play rock and roll.
Well, the new record that you have is called The Neighborhood, and it's also the name of one of the songs on the record. Does that song have to do with what we've been talking about now, your feelings about the old neighborhood and your feelings about the new neighborhood that you've recently moved to?
Yeah, definitely. More directly than ever before, we're a lot of our songs were written in this narrative style that told a story of a particular thing that we emphasized to be on a universal base, so that we could talk about things that people could relate to, even though our direct experience was, you know, Mexican American, or you know, the struggles of you know, assimilating and homogenizing yourself to a different culture. And we took those themes and made them so that they can be interpreted by anyone else living in some kind of setting that is affected by social and economic pressures. But in this song directly, I think more than ever before, we're focusing on one particular thing, and that's the urban struggle, the problems in the inner city with gangs and violence and drugs. And we took that song and we took one particular family, and we took them apart to tell this story about people that are just living under that vice grip of the reality of living in that inner city.
Well, this is The Neighborhood. It was co-written by my guests Luis Perez and David Hidalgo, and David sings lead.
Love.
That's The Neighborhood from the new Los Lobos record. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Luis Perez and David Hidalgo of the group Los Lobos, and they have a new record called The Neighborhood. How did you both meet? You seem awfully close.
It was in the 10th grade at James A. Garfield High School in an art class. We'd prop up the easel table and just kind of, you know, BS all period long instead of doing our assignments. So that was the beginning of a long friendship that's been, I don't know, over almost 20 years now.
So you were both playing instruments when you met?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of music were you playing on your own?
Gee, I guess it was kind of, I guess, blues-based rock, mostly, I guess. At that time, you know, playing in backyard parties and all this, it was, you'd do, Allman Brothers or Savoy Brown or Fleetwood Mac covers.
Yeah, Blues and A.
Blues and A for an hour.
Yeah, you know. pick a key and go on forever.
Yeah. Solo. Yeah.
David, you play accordion among other instruments. Did you have trouble figuring out a way to fit the accordion into your music at all, especially the rock and roll aspects of the music?
No, it just seemed to it. I think when the accordion came into the band, like the band changed around it,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
How did it change?
We just the sound and the feel of the accordion, you know, more or less dictated to, you know, what the rest of the band was going to do. I mean, like, we came to the accordion, like the accordion drew us in, you know, like, and it became like the center of our music for a long time. With the accordion, you have you can do the Tex-Mex music, and you can also do. You know, the music from South Louisiana, and so that's through that music is where, you know, with like the Zydeco and stuff, where the blues element comes in. That's where more or less the rock and roll snuck in that way, you know.
Why did you name the band Los Lobos?
Well, it started off kind of like as a joke, because in the Southwest, there's a lot of bands that just call themselves a lot of different names, and there was a band called. Los Lobos del Norte, which means the Wolves of the North, which were, you know, kind of like a popular norteño Tex-Mex group. And as just for, yeah, it's a joke, like always, we kind of, you know, we laugh through life is our kind of policy here. So we were kidding around about a name. We call ourselves Los Lobos del Este, with Wolves from the East. So we were from East L.A., so that we just kept that for a long time. And we just shared the last part of the name, just kept Los Lobos.
Luis Perez and David Hidalgo are my guests of the group Los Lobos. I guess the best-known record that you made was La Bamba from the movie of the same name about Ritchie Valens. And I was wondering if Ritchie Valens was someone who was important to you when you were growing up, if you liked his records?
Yeah, well, the music was around. I don't think we realized, you know, who he was or what he actually meant to Mexican Americans back when we were kids. We just heard it at every wedding that we ever went to, you know. But I guess in the late 70s, we started getting into his music, you know, and trying to find out anything about him that we could, you know. And he was a role model, you know, to a lot of Mexican American musicians or Latinos, I guess.
David, you did the voice for the record, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you try to do anything to get the Ritchie Valens voice?
Well, we a couple of songs there, we sped up the tape a little bit to knock off a few years. You know? And it was hard. There was a few things, like, especially the ballads, because he was a great ballad singer. He had this whisper, you know, like the way he sang Donna. That was hard to get close to, you know. But I learned something from it, you know.
What'd you learn?
that he was a great singer. No, he really was a good singer, you know, trying to get close to his stuff. But I don't know, on Donna, he does this whisper that it kind of reminds me of Stan Getz, you know, where you hear the note, but you hear the air coming out it, you know, it's pretty wild. Trying to interpret his songs, you know, I just realized that, you know, how talented he was.
Did you listen to the records over and over and over again?
Yeah, at first, when we started to record. Some of the things we had a little more freedom with, like the songs that were lesser known. But like something like Donna, we were like, racking our brains, trying to figure out how they recorded this, you know.
We
had to research it, I guess.
You had all this money and high technology to get the sound of a really cheap record, right?
Yeah,
that was the hard part.
That was the hardest.
To get it sound like a cheap recording. You know?
And drag the mics around the parking lot for a while. And to try to approach a recording technique or something that would give you that sort of those results, you know, the old time sound.
Louis, what did you have to do for the drums to get the sound you wanted?
Well, he was talking about Donna, you know, we stacked cymbals on top of each other to just get them to sound old and cheap, and that one evening we recorded Donna. It was scary. We got into this kind of one thing, and there was just one take that was absolutely just frightening. That the way it was just so ghostly and so just so close to the feel of the original track that, you know, we all just called it a night and went home.
What effect did it have on you to have a big hit like La Bamba? I imagine it brought out new people who had different expectations of you than your previous audiences had.
Or no knowledge of our existence before that. Fortunately, we had a few records before that, so we were able to kind of justify, you know who we were, that there was really more to us than what I guess ultimately just came off as, you know, kind of commercial hit or something, you know. So the audience changed a great deal. We had a bunch of young kids, you know, coming to the shows, and you know, the parents bringing along these, you know, real, you know, children. And that was kind of neat, you know, just to see kids and have them come back and ask for autographs and that sort of thing. But it took a while for us to realize what was going on.
Why don't we listen to the Los Lobos recording of Donna? My guests are David Hidalgo and Luis Perez of Los Lobos. Is it any coincidence that you did your most Mexican record after La Bamba?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a good one. For us, I think it was reaffirming our roots. Our other records followed this natural sort of progression, and then this record came along, which, you know, was we considered to be kind of outside of our just normal, you know, artistic growth. So to get back on track, it seemed that it was almost like a reaction to it was our way of responding to successes, to just dig deeper into to what we were all about. So it was also a timely thing. We were just about to celebrate our 15th anniversary together, so it was justified as our, you know, 15th anniversary record. At the same time, it did help us out to kind of recognize that old, the music that really got us started, and to almost like a responsible way to react to success, because, you know, that was a period when everybody was looking at us. And it gave us, make this artistic statement, almost political statement, where we played Mexican music that that was so exotic that some of this regional music had never been even heard by a lot of people living in the United States, let alone different parts of the world. So we were able to take success and use it in a way that we could, you know, serve up this ethnic, you know, platter of different musics to the rest of the world. And at the same time, it created a little bit of a buffer between La Bamba and our next rock record, so it gave us a little breathing spot.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
Luis Perez and David Hidalgo of the band Los Lobos. Their new album, The Neighborhood, is about to come out. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond. He fled Hungary in 1956 and has come to be one of Hollywood's leading cinematographers. He won an Academy Award for Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and he just shot The Two Jakes. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Los Lobos.
No lloraba y negara que un tiempo fuiste mía. Es muy cierto que lloré cuando era niño y también cuando sufrí a mis pobres padres, pero nunca lloraré por un cariño. Eso lo hacen solamente los cobardes. Tienes mucho miedo a que te siga. Cuando quieras reformar tu mundo aparte, hasta nunca vete, Dios que te bendiga.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, The Devil in a Blue Dress. It's a new mystery about a black detective. One of the mysteries is comprehending the white world. We talk with writer Walter Mosley. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new albums by jazz saxophonist, one by Chinese-American Fred Ho, and the other by Carlos Actistado from Italy. And music critic Milo Miles remembers guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan. Vaughan was killed today in a helicopter crash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The State Department has announced plans to expel 36 Iraqi diplomats in retaliation for Iraq's actions against Americans in Kuwait and Iraq. NPR's Ann Garrels has more on the story.
State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the staff at the Iraqi embassy in Washington is to be reduced by two-thirds, from 55 to 19. That's exactly the number of American diplomats left in Kuwait and Iraq. The State Department has forbidden those Iraqi diplomats remaining in Washington to travel more than 25 miles from the capital. And the State Department held open the possibility of still further moves against Iraq if warranted. Speaking to reporters in Kennebunkport, Maine, President Bush said he doesn't believe these steps will escalate tensions in the Gulf, stressing the United States is not detaining any Iraqis. The United States is optimistic other nations will take similar measures. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Iraq has allowed 52 Americans to cross into Turkey while turning back three members of the group who were sons of diplomats. The 52 are dependents of diplomats from the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. Last week, Iraq ordered embassies closed in Kuwait, but most countries said that they did not recognize Iraq's takeover of its neighbor and have refused to heed the order. King Hussein of Jordan is now in Tunisia on the second leg of his tour of all five North African states as he tries to find a peaceful solution to the Gulf crisis. From Tunis, Peter Hyatt filed this report.
The king arrived in Tunis after having two rounds of talks in Libya with Colonel Gaddafi. Here, he's seen the Secretary General of the Arab League and had a long meeting with senior PLO officials. He was due to see President Ben Ali before leaving for Algeria and then Morocco and Mauritania. Few details have emerged of his talk so far, though it's clear he's continuing to try to find an Arab solution to the Gulf crisis. King Hussein is concentrating on those countries which did not criticize Iraq at the Arab summit in Cairo earlier this month. While King Hussein was in Tunis, Arab League officials confirmed that there would be another League meeting in Cairo on Thursday. Significantly, it's the same 12 states which voted against Iraq that have agreed to this new meeting. Observers here say it's now clearer than ever that the Arab world is splitting into pro- and anti-Iraqi camps. For National Public Radio, this is Peter Hyatt in Tunis.
France has called on the UN to send a mission to Kuwait to protect foreign diplomats there from Iraqi forces. About two dozen embassies in Kuwait have defied Iraq's order to close. Water and power to the missions have been cut, and according to officials in Paris, the French embassy has been circled by Iraqi troops. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 79 points to close at 2,611.63, volume 160 million shares. Advancing issues led decline 6-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, we remember blues guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan. But first, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says one reason that jazz is so popular around the world is the music's ability to stretch, to incorporate ideas from many cultures. Kevin has a review of new records by two saxophonists from very different backgrounds who take very different approaches to the music.
Jazz was born when different cultures rubbed up against each other, when African rhythms met European harmony. But because personal expression is at the heart of jazz, players from various backgrounds continue to bring other strains to it. One of the fascinating things about jazz is watching how musicians from different cultures do that. For example, take composer and saxophonist Fred Ho, a first-generation Chinese-American. On that piece, Fred Ho's soprano sax echoes the sound of the Japanese bamboo flute, the shakuhachi. He plays Asian music on a jazz instrument. That number comes from a recent release by Ho's sextet, the Afro-Asian Music Ensemble. The album's called We Refuse to Be Used and Abused. It's on the Soul Note label. Elsewhere on the album, where Ho plays stomping baritone sax, the music doesn't have any obviously recognizable Asian elements. Thank you. But Fred Ho also serves up a traditional Chinese song, When the Sun Rises, the Guava Turns Red. First he plays it straight, and then jazzes it up a little. By playing Chinese, Japanese, and straight jazz tunes, Fred Ho refuses to be pigeonholed musically. His music illuminates the ways the children of immigrants do and don't assimilate into the American mainstream, if you accept jazz as part of mainstream American culture. And now for something completely different. That's the Carlo Actis Dado Quartet from Italy, with Dado and Piero Ponzi playing saxes and clarinets. Italy has a thriving and varied jazz scene, but no jazz band I've heard sounds as unabashedly Italian as this one. I find their music irresistible. Carlo Actis Dado's new album, Ankara Twist, is on the Italian Splash label. You don't have to know much about Italian folk music or dance steps to spot the ethnic strains in Dado's jazz, or to recognize the band's nutty sense of humor. It's as if discovering jazz had given them the power to set loose something in their own souls. Here's a little of a piece whose title translates as Ugly Ducklings.
Musica per ben, se non c'è attenzione, non smettete di parlare, non si può, se non c'è silenzio. E la massima attenzione! No, non si può.
I don't have a clue what they're talking about there, or any place else where Dado and company break into song. But that doesn't bother me too much. Listening to this music, I can imagine how people overseas must feel when they first hear American jazz. Dado's music is loaded with culturally specific references that sail right over my head. Still, as with any good jazz, its universal qualities speak louder than its particulars. I might have trouble understanding it, but I know what I like.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed new albums by Fred Ho and Carlo Actis Dado. This is Fresh Air. Crime novels have been dominated by white detectives. There's a new entry in the genre that features a black hero. The story is set in Los Angeles in 1948, The main character is Easy Rollins, a World War II veteran who just got laid off from his job at a defense plant for standing up to his boss. Easy is broke, so he accepts an offer from a white gangster to track down a white woman who has a predilection for black men. The search takes Easy into all the black bars he knows, but it also leads him into parts of the white world he's unfamiliar with, people and places that are hostile to a black man. Out of these situations, you get Easy's observations about race in America. The novel is called Devil in a Blue Dress. It's the first book by my guest Walter Mosley. Mosley is in his late 30s, grew up in Los Angeles, and now lives in New York. This is the opening of Devil in a Blue Dress.
I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he wore an off-white linen suit and shirt with a Panama straw hat and bone shoes over flashing white silk socks. His skin was smooth and pale with just a few freckles. One lick of strawberry blonde hair escaped the band of his hat. He stopped in the doorway, filling it with his large frame, and surveyed the room with pale eyes, not a color I'd ever seen in a man's eyes. When he looked at me, I felt a thrill of fear, but that went away quickly because I was used to white people by 1948. I had spent 5 years with white men and women from Africa to Italy, through Paris and into the fatherland itself. I ate with them and slept with them, and I killed enough blue-eyed young men to know that they were just as afraid to die as I was.
Now, your novel set in 1948, which is around 4 years before you were born.
Yeah.
This is based on stories your father told you? I don't mean the story of the novel, but the setting, the period.
Yeah, the idea is when I was a little kid, maybe 5, 6, 7, I would be with my father and his friends, and they would tell stories which really kind of came into my heart. I mean, you know, when you're a little kid and you listen to these wild stories that people are telling, they become part of you. So it's like I was alive then, in a way.
What were most of the stories about?
Most of the stories are about survival and having a good time. I think most of the stories are about how hard life was and how enjoyable life was. You know, a story once my father told me he was in a bar with his wife and his cousin. And some guy was bothering his wife. And my father, as a young man, pulls a knife on this guy. And my cousin grabbed the knife out of his hand because she said that if she killed the guy, she could get out of trouble by morning. And she tried to stab the guy, and she stabbed my father instead in the leg.
Jeez.
That was funny. But, like, she was there, and my father was there, and they were all laughing about it, and it was, like, a great time. So I thought it was wonderful.
How did she plan, by the way, to get out of trouble if she killed the guy?
There was an idea, at least, that she had that if a man attacked a black woman or had a fight with a black woman, a black man, that the judge wouldn't worry about it, just let him go in Houston. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's what they thought.
Now, your character of Easy Rollins fought in World War II, and that's where he was first really around a lot of other white men. Did your father fight in the war?
He was in the war. He was in World War II. He was in Europe. But most black soldiers really didn't have to fight in the war. You could if you wanted to, but you had to volunteer, really. So he was in the statistics unit, and he never did fight.
Did the experience mean as much to your father as it did to the life of your character of Easy Rollins?
Yeah, I think so. I think in that way, Easy reflects my father. My father, when he returned to Houston, found that more of his friends in the war had survived than friends who had lived in Houston. People were killed, died of various diseases, and weren't nearly as well taken care of in Houston, Texas, as they were in Europe fighting. So he decided that it wasn't good to live in Houston, so he went to Los Angeles.
Wow. Was there an equivalent of the war in terms of an experience or something that exposed you to the white world? Or did you just grow up in a racially mixed world, unlike your father?
Yeah, my mother's white. And I've always been in a racially mixed world. But a lot of the people that I was with, it was new to them, or always new to them, like white people who had only been around white people most of their lives and most of their important experiences, so had trouble with black people, and vice versa.
Although your mother was white and your father was black, when you were outside of the family, did people just see you as black as opposed to, you know, being of a mixed background?
Well, yeah. I mean, in America, you're black if you're at all black, right? I mean, there's not really too much difference between being half black or quarter black and all black. I mean, you are if you are.
Your novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, takes the main character into parts of the white world that he's not used to and not comfortable in. And a lot of the book is really about your main character's perceptions about the differences between white life and black life. And I'm wondering why you use the detective genre to make those observations.
I use the detective genre because of the moral aspect of, like, most really good detective novels, where the detective or the main character has to figure out what's right and what's wrong in a world where right and wrong might be defined, but you might have to do wrong to be right or vice versa.
There's a scene where Easy gets arrested by cops, and he says, well, he's played the game of cops and nigger before. What's the game?
Well, the game is not giving up information, basically. That they're going to have an attitude that you did something wrong. And that's not going to change. And so you're going to have to continually say, I didn't do it. I'm not wrong. And they're going to continually say that you are. And you just have to weather that. I've experienced that. I got stopped by a policeman in Los Angeles in the hills. And the guy actually pulled a gun on me and asked me, did I break into this building that was standing there? And I had to keep saying no. And he kept holding his gun on me saying, I know you did it. Now all you have to do is tell me. And I was so nervous. But it just kind of went away after a while.
It's hard to convince someone that you're innocent when they're certain that you're guilty.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's kind of hard to convince yourself, actually. You know, when there's enough pressure to say you're guilty, you feel, well, I'll be safe if I say I'm guilty. He won't shoot me if I do that, or he won't hit me, or he won't put me in jail. Then maybe I'll just say that. But, of course, that doesn't work either.
You know, without giving away too much about your novel, I will say that one character in it is of mixed background,
mm-hmm.
Like you are, but they are really screwed up.
Yeah.
I mean, they cannot handle being part white and part black.
Yeah.
Did you have friends like that who really couldn't handle it?
Well, it's an interesting thing when the idea of being a mulatto in America, because what I said before, externally people see you as being black, but internally, of course, you identify with people who you're close to and you loved. I've been very close to my mother's side of the family as well as my father's. So there's a kind of an alienation you feel from almost everyone, because you'll find, or at least I found when I was growing up, that a lot of black people felt that white people were different, not the same. And that's not something I ever felt. I said, well, you know, white people are like me, because these are people I've known my whole life. So, and as far as that's concerned, yes, I identify with the character that you're talking about in the book.
But did you know someone who really kind of went over the edge because they couldn't handle it?
No, I don't know anybody personally who has. Mm-hmm. You know, only stories of people, you know, people who passed for white, people who just didn't want to be black.
So what's going to happen in your sequel?
Well, my idea for this series of books is to write 6 Easy Rollins mysteries. And they'll be separated by decades, more or less. One in the 40s, one in the 50s, two in the 60s, one in the 70s, one in the 80s. And Easy, of course, is going to get old. People around him are going to die. And he's going to go through various periods of, you know, political and social change. The next book happens in 1952, and it's going to be at least partially about the McCarthy era, about, you know, chasing down communists and how lower class black people relate to this the idea of communism and the country in general.
So this series, in a way, is a chance for you to investigate parts of the past that you either didn't live through or were very young when it was happening, or
yeah.
You lived through but you were a completely different age than the perspective you're writing from.
Right. No, it's you know, the past is an interesting, and the recent past or history is an interesting thing because you live through it because people you know live through it. And this past informed their lives, and they informed your life. So it's me dealing with kind of pure emotions that I experienced through my father and my friends, etc.
Is your father still alive?
Yeah. My parents are both alive.
I wonder, since the book seems in a way like, well, an almost homage to your father. I mean, because there seems to be a lot of the stories he told in there. What he thinks of the book?
Well, he likes the book, actually. Though it's very funny. I was talking to him a few months ago when he first read it. And he asked me, seriously, I think, he says, well, Walter, where am I in this book? And I thought it was so funny. Because I told him, I said, well, you know, a lot has to do with, you know, your history, your background and stuff. But he couldn't notice it. And I thought that was very funny.
Well, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay. Thank you, too.
Walter Mosley's novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, is published by Norton. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what stories do you have from the Persian Gulf?
Hi, Terry. It was a reasonably peaceful day in the Persian Gulf crisis as diplomats begin to talk about a negotiated settlement. The State Department, though, has ordered 2/3 of the Iraqi diplomatic staff in the U.S. to leave. Also, the State Department moves to take control of Iraqi embassy funds used by Iraqi students in this country. A report from New York by NPR's Maria Inahosa on how New Yorkers are being affected by the crisis in the Persian Gulf, their lives and their mortgage rates. Also, a remembrance of blues guitar player Stevie Ray Vaughan, who died this morning in a plane crash in Wisconsin.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Blues guitarist and singer Stevie Ray Vaughan died this morning in a helicopter crash. He was 35 years old. Vaughan had just finished a performance in Wisconsin, sharing the bill with Eric Clapton, Robert Cray, and Buddy Guy. Stevie Ray Vaughan's first album, Texas Flood, came out in 1983, and music critic Marlo Miles says it established him right away as the finest new blues guitarist of the decade. He was constantly in demand as a concert draw and turned out a very popular video with his cover of Stevie Wonder's Superstition. Music critic Milo Miles is on the line with us. Hi, Milo.
Hi.
What made Stevie Ray Vaughan important?
Well, one of the things that Stevie Ray Vaughan did that was so unique, I think, is that there's a very strong current in the blues to simplify it and make it into either a museum piece these days or a simple kind of party music. And he was able to personalize the blues very strongly, especially in his playing. It was evident that he was very fluid from the start as a guitarist, but as he went along, he began to get the feeling of the blues inside of himself in a very deep way, and I think that that's a crucial thing to becoming an important blues player. And it was also significant that he was able to incorporate elements from soul and elements from R&B and elements from funk all into his playing, so it was blended into this nice, potent whole that came across very well often, especially in concert, where he delivered a lot more than just good time stuff. It was really an experience to see him play at his best.
When a musician dies unexpectedly, you wonder what they would have been able to do had they lived. What's your sense about Vaughan?
Well, the thing that strikes me about this is that it's very similar to Roy Orbison. After someone they'd decided that they'd established themselves on a certain level and then were sort of pigeonholed, he suddenly comes back and transcends himself and is doing better than ever and then disappears. With his last record from 89, In Step, he came back for some personal problems, and it seemed that he'd really gotten a hold of what was going on and was saying his own voice, finally was fully his own at last. And he might have gone on to really take the blues by the tail and make it very alive. His playing is at a peak on In Step, and he can take a number and just completely stretch it out into a whole new direction. One that I particularly like is Love Me, Darling on In Step, and it's by Howlin' Wolf from 1964. And yet when Stevie Ray grabs a hold of it, it doesn't sound like anything like a recreation or anything like a look backwards. It's just a very lively contemporary number.
Well, Milo, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice and reports on world music for Fresh Air. This is Stevie Ray Vaughan. Stevie Ray Vaughan and his brother Jimmy recorded an album together that's scheduled to be released next month. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vilmos Zsigmond, the cinematographer who shot The Two Jakes, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, The Deer Hunter, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Also, we meet musician and record producer Don Was of the group Was Not Was. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.